So the first anomaly that I'll talk about is LS&D. They had their experiment was a proton beam at 800 MeV impinging on some target here, and then a whole bunch of neutrinos were produced. Their detector is sitting off slightly at a slight angle with the beam axis. What they were looking for is a signal of anti-muon neutrinos converting into anti-electron neutrinos by looking for, this reaction. And when they accounted for their backgrounds and subtracted all of that off, then they saw an excess that was different from zero at about 4 sigmas. So they interpret that as an oscillation probability that's somewhat large and in some disagreement with other sorts of neutrino experiments. So so that's what they see. And this is weird. And I'll just point out these the fluxes of neutrinos at the LCD detector. And I'll just make a note that the left-hand side is neutrinos from decays at rest, and the right-hand side from decays in flight. It's probably difficult to see, but the scale here is 10 to the 12 per bin, basically, and over here is 10 to the 9. So there's about 1,000 more neutrinos from decays at rest. That's sort of the maximum energy that there are here. So, and then the other feature that I'll just point out is that these decay at rest neutrinos have a kinematic kind of cutoff here at about 50 or so MeV. So there aren't any neutrinos from decays at rest above 50 MeV, so that's just something to take note of. Important.
Sorry, so sure. Is that a prime decay or what?
Yeah. So the other experiment.
And the decay flight is both from pylons and muons.
Right, yes, yeah. And the muons coming from the pylons as well. So. Yes. Well, yeah, the whatever the parents of these neutrinos. But yeah, the point that will be salient is just that essentially there's this cutoff, right? For, and these are kind of a negligible sort of perturbation on the decay at rest. So the second experiment is more or less a rehash of LS&D. The only difference being, so the beam here is the same energy and about the same amount of data was collected. The only difference here, this is the Carmen experiment, is that the detector is at a large angle with respect to the beam line, so 90 degrees. And the other important thing is that they don't observe any excess in mu bar to nu v bar. So that's weird because it's the same experiment. The last one that I'd like to briefly talk about is mini boom.
So the experiment was just more flexible.
I'm sorry? Well, they ended up taking about 5 times less data altogether. And I guess that's normalized for the flux here is a little bit different from the flux at LCD. That's what
because it's a different angle?
Because it's a different angle, yeah. And so that will be the important point in this solution.
That's, maybe it's not the right answer, but was there any good reason for that choice? Or?
I actually don't know why that choice was made, but I think it was probably some kind of constraints about where just physically things could be. But yeah, I suppose ideally they would... Well, there's probably some varying trade-offs kind of between putting your detector closer to the beam line and then, so. But I actually don't know the reason that this part is just, so yes, the last experimental anomaly is, comes from mini boom. And here the protons that are, hitting this beryllium target are about 10 times more energetic than in the Carmen or LS&D case. And here they're actually looking for, what they observe are Cherenkov rings from the charged particles that are traversing their mineral oil detector. And so what they observe are, photons and electrons essentially look about the same to them. And the first data released by Miniboon was looking for an excess in nu mu to nu e, so the charge conjugate process was in e. And the mixing angle that they found was not actually consistent with LSD, so that's kind of bizarre, but the sort of important or strange feature, the anomaly, I guess, in this case is at low energies, they saw some excess from the predicted background here. So. And then they had a run, a short run, I guess, with looking for nu mu bar, so nu e bar oscillations, and what they found was not inconsistent with zero, but not consistent enough with zero to rule out LSD, I suppose. So, so what do these anomalies mean? I guess this is in order of descending insanity. So there could be some misunderstanding of neutrino fluxes. So it's
descending insanity or
okay. So this makes more sense than this, I guess. Is what I'm.
So ascending insanity.
Yeah. So ascending insanity. Yeah.
So conservative. Ascending insanity.
I'm sorry.
So conservative, so young.
Well, no, I mean, but I'll still ignore these things and so maybe it's just stupidity. Conservative, but stupid. So a lot like I guess I could run for office.
Experience in the field.
Yeah. Okay, so we might not actually know what the absolute flux of the various neutrino flavors are at the different detectors. These are hard things to model. They require a bunch of Monte Carlos that I haven't worked with, and so I can't really personally say that it's vouch for it, but that does seem like a you know, something that's not insane. With regards to the Miniboon anomaly, there could be some unaccounted for standard model background of that produces photons instead of electrons in the target. And as far as Miniboon is concerned, those are about the same thing. And so this was Jeff Hardy, Chris Hill, and Richard Hill had some ideas about that. So that could be an explanation of the Miniboon anomaly, at least. But yes, having briefly mentioned these things, maybe it's something new, and that's sort of the tack that I'll take.
Can I ask you a question about your first one?
Sure.
Which you can just ignore. The size of the experiment is such that you expect no oscillations.
I'm sorry.
The size of that experiment is such that the energy over L is such that you don't expect to see any oscillations.
Yeah.
So how will different flux help you here?
So essentially, what they're at LSD you're talking about, right?
Right.
Okay. So.
Or Carmen.
Yeah. So if there's some other source of so what they see are these anti-electron neutrinos.
Right.
And if there's some other source,
I
won't. Yeah. In the target.
Okay, but that's not really a different flux issue. That's really identifying a new process that produces.
Which then enters into your estimate of how many electron neutrinos are in your beam of neutrinos to begin with, I suppose. But yeah, it's a production process issue. So maybe flux, I don't know if that's the right term.
You see, because the flux issue came about very recently because, you know, they never measure the flux, but you measure the flux in electrons,
mm-hmm.
and then you convolve theoretically back the flux of neutrinos you expect.
Right. So maybe, that expected neutrino
flux
is numerically different.
Yeah.
So there's some
people... But you really need a new production mechanism of multi-neutrinos.
I believe so, yeah. But, there's some people who talk about diffractive neutron scattering and stuff and how that's maybe not well understood as a source of neutrinos.
So you actually think the hadronic flux has never been measured with it?
Well, because most of the neutrinos come actually out from
probably atomic stuff, right? Like ion decays and chain decays.
Right.
But that has not been measured.
Well, what people do now is they have those double near and far detectors. And then you normalize all the flux in the far detector, the flux you observe in the near detector. And that's the most reliable way to understand the flux. But what people usually do for those experiments where you don't have the detectors is you measure the electronic flux. Because you know that with every neutrino you always have an electron. And you try to infer from that the flux of neutrinos. So in that sense it's a measurement. So it's
so maybe it's something new. And so I'll start talking about something new. So there was a model in September, I guess, by this guy named Nienko that introduced a sterile neutrino, which I'll call N, that has a sizable mixing strength with the muon-type neutrino. And it also has a large transition magnetic moment with light neutrinos through some sort of an interaction that looks like this. And so essentially, what Nienko wants is for a, in a new mu or new mu bar beam, through this mixing, these sterile neutrinos are produced, and then through this transition magnetic moment, the sterile neutrino decays to a photon and a light neutrino. And so this photon is depositing energy in your detectors, and so that's what's interpreted at LS&D as a, and at Minigoon, I guess, as something in their signal. So. So, what I'm saying, I guess, is that this is the reaction that is responsible, in quotes, for the LS&D anomaly. And Karman's geometry, being at 90 degrees from the beam axis, means that there aren't enough neutrinos that have enough energy to produce this sterile neutrino if that sterile neutrino is above about 40 MeV in mass.
So it's also, there are actually two ingredients, right? One is the magnetic moment,
mm-hmm.
and the second one is the sterile neutrino.
Yeah, and then the third is the mixing angle that has to be somewhat large. And we'll find out how large it is. But so the, essentially, the idea is that the neutrinos from the decays at rest at the LS&D target are able to, or there's enough of them that are emitted sort of, So the neutrinos that are decaying in flight at LS&D are what are producing these sterile neutrinos, and since this detector is close to the beam axis, there's a large enough flux of them. However, at Karman, that's not the case because of this large angle here. And so this shows the neutrino energy at each detector. This blue histogram is at Karman. The unshaded histogram is at LS&D. And this arrow indicates the threshold for this reaction to take place. So essentially, this geometry and the mass of this neutrino are what explain the fact that Karman doesn't see anything, whereas LS&D does. And so, at LS&D, to give a reasonable fit to their spectra, you need a sterile neutrino, which is in that same tens of MeV mass range. The mixing angle with the muon neutrino squared has to be about 10 to the minus 3 or so, and its lifetime has to be less than 10 to the minus 8 seconds for it to deposit energy, or to decay promptly enough. And like I was saying before, Karman requires its mass to be about 40 MeV. And fitting to Minigoon is a little bit easier, I suppose. There's a larger range of sterile neutrino masses. The mixing is sort of in the same ballpark, and here the lifetime has to be less than 10 to the minus 9 seconds, since it's a little bit more energetic, I guess. The new mu bar data is compatible with any mixing angle less than about 10 to the minus 2, mixing angle squared. And yeah, it can be conceivably explained by a zero mixing angle since it's not inconsistent with zero. So you might ask why a sterile neutrino with this large of a mixing with a muon neutrino and this mass hasn't been seen before. So shown here are constraints on the mixing angle squared as a function of sterile neutrino mass. And so down here at small masses, you can produce this sterile neutrino in pi to mu mu decays. But above about 40 MeV or so, kinematically that process doesn't happen, so there's no more constraints above there. You can also look for it in decays of kaons, but the background sort of creep up as the sterile neutrino mass decreases, and that comes from processes where you actually are producing the photon, which would look like the signal from this radiatively decaying sterile neutrino that get rejected because experimentally people didn't want to look for this, so these events would be rejected. And so there's sort of a small weird window here around 50 MeV that isn't strictly constrained by these sorts of particle decays. So right here is indicated where the rough value of the squared mixing angle and mass that is needed to explain LCD. So it's kind of, there's a little bit of tension, but it's argued, I guess, that this that there isn't any super solid constraint here. And so the mixing angle has to be about, like I was saying, about 10 to the minus 3 or so, and the mass is about 50 MeV. So there's also constraints from LEP for this process where you create two photons in a, two neutrinos in a photon, which would, so one of these neutrinos in the photon are the, would, could be interpreted as the decay products of the sterile neutrino. And so this requires that the sterile neutrino live long enough that it not decay promptly at LEP, which turns out to be about 10 to the minus 11 seconds. And there's also, constraints from the shell parameters in muon decay, but they turn out not to be, there'll be another plot on the next slide that shows them a bit better, but they turn out not to be actually normal.
So what was that?
So they, they look at a lot of muon decays, and then the spectrum of the electron and sort of the shape of the endpoint tells you about how massive a neutrino can be. And so you can get some kind of a picture of, well, I think in Fermi's original four fermion operator paper, he talked about doing this sort of measurement to get an idea of what the neutrino mass is. And so how the endpoint looks gives you a picture of what the neutrino mass is.
Okay.
Sure.
Have you guys looked at whether it's going to affect the running of alpha? Because that sort of thing will affect at some level right through. If you're coupled into the photon, the event's a dipole. So, and people have measured the running of alpha from the electron mass.
Sure.
Maybe it's just more.
I have to admit that I didn't consider it. So I don't know numerically, but it seems like it would be kind of small. Because this is some, I mean, the coupling, while large, is still extremely small, this radiative, magnetic transition magnetic moment.
So what was the point? Yes, the dipole. Or what is your one over? What is the one over the mass of the dipole?
So you're asking what is the one over the mass?
Yeah.
Let's see. So this has to be about 10 to the minus 8 Bohr magnetons. So that's 1 over mass of the electron. Yeah. Summarizing what Nikos crazy sterile neutrinos require in parameter space.
You're taped.
I wish I didn't know that. So the mixing angle has to be about 10 to the minus 3 or so. Mass between 40 and 80 MeV. The lifetime between 10 to the minus 11 and 10 to the minus 9 seconds. And it has to decay basically completely radiant. And so this is the region of the parameter space with the mass on the horizontal and the mixing angle squared on the vertical. And so LS&D requires this dark shaded region here. Mini-boon is sort of anywhere between this dotted line here and this solid line. And then the twist constraints look something like that. So of course, as the mixing angle gets quite large, they become important, but they sort of become less important as one dials up the mass for a fixed mixing angle. Down here below 40 MeV is excluded by these pi to nu. Pi to muon and neutrino decays, and then above 80 is excluded by these kaon to muon and neutrino decays. So this is sort of the relevant parameter space that we'll try to deal with. So just take a step back and talk, have a little digression, I guess, about muon capture and radiative muon capture. So ordinary muon capture is given by the reaction that looks like this here. So we have a proton and a muon in some bound state. And then occasionally the muon can turn into a neutrino, the proton into a neutron, and you don't actually see any electron ejected or anything like that. So in hydrogen, this process occurs about 10 to the minus 8, with a branching ratio of about 10 to the minus 8. This with the branching ratio of about 10 to the minus 3. Radiative of muon capture is the same process, but we just stick a photon in here somewhere. And that has a branching ratio in hydrogen of about 10 to the minus 8.
But you can actually, where is the gamma really coming from? Not from radiating away the binding energy, because that always happens, right? The capture of the muon into the bound state of the proton, there is always a gamma in it, because that's just the binding energy.
Well, the neutrino could carry that binding energy away, I guess.
Oh, sure.
As well.
Yes, of course, so.
But to a good approximation, these guys are at rest. And so the amount of energy that this neutrino carries away is fixed, right? And so if we have ordinary muon capture, so what the interest in this process is at looking at the weak current between nucleons. And so you can write it down like this. And if you look at ordinary muon capture, you get an idea about all of these different form factors, the weak current between a proton and a neutron. But if it's ordinary muon capture, then it's at one fixed Q squared. So whereas if it's radiative muon capture, then you can, by looking at different energies of the photon here, you can probe different values of Q squared. And so even though...
So the gamma comes off from the initial state radiation.
Yeah, it could come off from the muon or the proton here, or the W or the pion, I guess, in some sense. It could be from this weak current. So, but by looking at it, by looking at the spectrum of those photons, then you can get at, and actually, even though the branching ratio is down by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 relative to ordinary muon capture, you can still actually get a better picture of, for instance, this pseudoscalar form factor between nucleons. So that allows you to test various models.
Yeah, I think I'm just confused, because the ordinary muon capture would be just an electromagnetic capture rather than muon.
So the ordinary muon capture?
You capture into the bound state.
Mm-hmm.
And you radiate over the bound.
So
that would be the ordinary, but the ordinary weak process.
Yeah, so I think muon capture. So you're talking about how this muon comes to be.
So it is already a muonium
Yeah, so great. So in practice, they fire a bunch of muons at liquid hydrogen, let's say, and these muons are captured or are slowed down, and then they're captured by this proton. Captured might be the wrong word here, but they tend to be in a quite high level, like n equals 14 or something, and then they cascade down, and they eventually come to be in the 1s state, and then from there, the vast majority of the time, the muon just decays normally to an electron and neutrinos. But one time in every thousand, the muon turns into a neutrino instead. Then one time every 100 million, it does that while also emitting a photon. And so this is physics that I had no idea about. Months ago or something, but now I know all of it. So the experimental situation with radiated muon capture is this, basically. So the best experiments are done here in Canada, or were done about 15 years ago or so. They had a liquid hydrogen target at about 16 Kelvin. One needs to, in practice, know what the singlet and triplet rates are. So if we put the muon and the proton in a spin singlet, the rate is a lot different, actually, than the rate for a spin triplet. So in practice, one needs to know that. One also needs to know how many or what the relative occupancies are of those different states. And then another added complication is that this muonium is mostly molecular at this temperature and pressure and not atomic, so you need to know how many are in the ortho or para states and then relate that to the singlet and triplet rates. So like I was saying before, the radiated muon capture rate is about 10 minus 8 in hydrogen. This is down by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 relative to ordinary muon capture. I should mention, I guess, that...
H2 is... So molecular means now H2, right? But just with electrons replaced by muons.
Right, or one of the electrons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, that's right. And then those, if it's a spin triplet, well, so if it's it's... the binding of, say, two spin triplets, then their spins could be either parallel or anti-parallel. And then the rates are slightly... There's some quantum mechanics that one needs to do to relate them to the bare singlet or bare triplet atomic muon capture rates. And then you have to know what your occupancies are each state to get a total rate. So I should mention that, these branching ratios are strongly dependent on Z, and so for aluminum, muons captured on aluminum, ordinary muon capture, the branching ratio for that is about 1/2 or so. So, and that's just because the Bohr radius is much smaller in that case. So the that's just something to take note of. Not terrible. The reason that I'm talking about muon capture and radiated muon capture is this stellar neutrino that Niemenko proposed would also lead to a signal that looks like radiative muon capture. And so basically the ingredient is that we have a stellar neutrino mixing with this muon neutrino here and then decaying radiatively. So this, as far as anyone's concerned, looks just like normal ordinary muon capture of producing this stellar neutrino followed by its radiative decay. And so radiative muon constraints, or radiative muon capture constraints could possibly have something to say about this. So the rate for this sterile neutrino-induced radiative muon capture is basically just given by the rate of ordinary muon capture producing sterile neutrino of mass, whatever it is. It's, of course, proportional to this mixing angle squared. And then the branching ratio of this sterile neutrino here, and then there's some energy spectrum of these photons. And so the one can use estimates of what those form factors in the this weak sorry this weak hadronic current are, and then one can get an estimate of what the rate for this process is. And so shown here is just the rate of ordinary muon capture is a function of, or producing a sterile neutrino of mass m over normal ordinary muon capture for both spin singlets and spin triplets. And like we would expect, the this rate decreases as we increase the mass since there's less less phase space here. And it decreases to be expected at zero mass. Normal ordinary muon capture. So we also have to keep track sort of the spin of this sterile neutrino. So if we go to the sterile neutrino's rest frame and then look at the decay, the radiative decay to a photon and a light neutrino, we can parameterize that decay. It looks like this, where theta is the angle between the spin of the sterile neutrino and the photon. For Dirac neutrinos, essentially A is a free parameter between zero or minus one and one, whereas for Majorana neutrinos, A is fixed to be zero. So A sort of just tells us how whether the sterile neutrino wants to emit a photon parallel or anti-parallel.
You're converting the nu mu as a little nu e.
I'm sorry?
What is your nu I? Is it mostly a light neutrino?
That's what I'm taking it to be for now.
So you need to worry about the things that that state may have an effective mass in matter? And then it's not there.
I think.
What else does this mean?
Like this is an effective potential from all the
right.
Nucleus.
Yeah.
For,
so,
so it has a place. Mass.
How large a mass do you think that would? Then,
well, because I'm not sure that it could be pretty large, right? Because the the mu neutrino is produced on shell, right? And then you emit on part shell.
So I'm imagining that the sterile neutrino is emitted or produced on shell, essentially. So there's some effective vertex here between a muon and a sterile neutrino. And I'm just producing it on shell. Yeah.
For that, I mean, this MSW is kind of a macroscopic effect, right? I mean, it's
Because I would think you would feel some sort of a chemical potential putting in an electron neutrino into that vessel. But it probably doesn't matter here because I mean it's producing the ion shell. So that's going to
be like 40 MeVs. It's relatively, I mean, this thing is, it travels centimeters typically.
But it's massive, like 50 MeVs or
so. Oh, yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah, so this that actually sort of anticipates sort of some slides coming up about what this new I, what I mean by it. So right now I'm just taking it to be some light neutrino that we could imagine it as being an electron type neutrino or muon type neutrino or something like that. For the time being, some light neutrino. And so, yes, like I was mentioning before, I'm imagining producing these ends on shell and through some V minus A sort of a current. And what I have plotted here is the helicity asymmetry as a function of the mass of this spiral neutrino. Because we have to keep track of the direction of these spiral neutrino spins if their decays are anisotropic to these bosons. So when ALR here is 1, that means that all of the spiral neutrinos helicities are, well, that all of their spins are pointed in the opposite direction of their momenta. Whereas when it's 0, it's an equal mixture of right and left-handed helicities. So as we'd expect, then if it's some massless neutrino produced through some left-handed current, then the helicities will also be the same as the chiralities here, and so they're all left-handed, and the chances of a helicity flip increases as one increases the mass. So then when you want to look for the, well, this becomes a practical consideration when you're looking at the energy spectrum of the decay photons. And so if these photons are emitted isotropically in the rest frame of the spiral neutrino, then there'll just be a flat spectrum in the lab of these photons. Whereas if they're emitted, let's say, preferentially backward, then that degrades the energy of the photons. And so you get some sort of spectrum that would look like this. And then if they're emitted preferentially forward, that boosts the photons, and so they the decay spectrum would look like something with a positive slope here. So I've shown here the spectrum for a 40 and an 80 MeV spiral neutrino with the photons preferentially emitted in the backward direction. So this is sort of the most conservative kind of a situation. Whereas if they were, like I was saying, isotropically emitted, this would just be a flat spectrum, and you could have positive slope if they're emitted preferentially in the forward direction. So putting all of this together, well, using the number of radiative muon capture events that were seen at Triumph, well, the branching ratio that they measured was about 10 to the minus 8 here. And then if we also require that the photon, that the spiral neutrino decay to a photon and light neutrino within the liquid hydrogen target, which has these dimensions of order tens of centimeters, which happens about 18% of the time for a 40 MeV spiral neutrino and about 43% of the time or so for a 80 MeV spiral neutrino, if its lifetime is less than 10 to the minus 9 seconds, which is the upper limit of a lifetime that the Mimenko scenario requires. So this makes sense because the lighter spiral neutrinos, of course, are moving a lot faster, and so they tend not to decay as often inside of the detector as one would expect. So if we just add up all of the counts here that the people at Triumph saw, and then require that the that number of counts be less than the number of spiral neutrino-induced radiative muon capture events, which is a pretty conservative sort of estimate, then we get the bounds that I'm showing here on the right. So these three separate bounds come from different choices of that parameter A, which describes the anisotropy of the spiral neutrino decay. And so, like I was saying before, this A equals 1 means that most of the photons are emitted in the backward direction, so their energies are tend to be lower. And so there's a cut here that the photon has to be above 60 MeV for this, well, for that's what their measurement is. And so the more low-energy photons we have, then the softer the bound becomes. Whereas the opposite case, where the stern neutrino preferentially emits a photon in the same direction as its momentum, which is, this case is a bit more tightly constrained. And so the limit on this squared mixing angle here tends to be around 10 to the minus 3 or less for the relevant range of stern neutrino masses. And so I've just shown here again the plot of the required area in parameter space for these stern neutrinos as far as this model is concerned. And so it's tough to see, I guess, but these bounds are kind of in this 10 to the minus 3 range here. So they're not as constraining, I guess, as the particle decay bounds, but they're decent and they're a bit more, they're less ambiguous down here. So so there's tension between this model and radiative gluon capture measurements. Suppose I should mention now that one can kind of get around these bounds, actually, if you make this some other sterile neutrino that's massive, then this photon, you could imagine making this massive enough that this photon is never close to 60 MeV. And so that would require about 20 MeV second sterile neutrino. So there is a catch, but and there's also further problems with this scenario. So I'll just briefly mention them. So the like I was mentioning before, if we have a stern neutrino that's decaying radiatively through an operator that looks like this, the value of this transition magnetic moment has to be about 10 to the minus 8 Bohr magnetons, which is quite large. And so at LS&D, for instance, you could imagine producing these sterile neutrinos not just through the charge current interaction that was originally produced or proposed, but through neutral current interactions like this. And so this N, sorry about the notation, this is a sterile neutrino, this is a nitrogen. But we could scatter off of some carbon in the mineral oil, and then this would look like the just some neutral current scattering that leaves the carbon intact, for instance. And with this value of the transition magnetic moment, given the neutrino fluxes that LS&D reports at their detector, then one gets a cross-section for this interaction that looks like this, about 10 to the minus 36 or so, down to 10 to the minus 38. Centimeters squared, and then turning that in, well, using the flux to turn that into a number of events, and you get about 10 to the minus 8 Bohr magnetons, which is sort of a lower bound on that. You get about 10 to the 5 events like this at LS&D, whereas they fit 18 of them, so that's troubling. But it also sort of suggest maybe a resolution, potential resolution. So if one has you could imagine dialing down the transition magnetic moment to the muon or electron neutrinos, which, so you get far fewer of these events, but you still make sure that the stern neutrino decays somewhat promptly by requiring that its transition magnetic moment to a tau or maybe some other stern neutrino is quite large. And so potentially that could be the production mechanism of these stern neutrinos at LS&D instead of through these charge currents with mixing, a large mixing angle, so you could avoid the particle physics and RNC constraints. But to actually really say for sure whether this is viable, you need to have some actual understanding of how often events that look like this could break up the carbon here and then give you a signal that looks like what they're looking for, which is a lot of work. Angular distributions of those emitted products are also concerned. Making something, some sort of sensible actual model of this might be tricky. These are all things that I just didn't want to do. Although maybe from my point of view, a more interesting thing is imagining maybe a new model of light dark matter that you could have some sterile neutrino, maybe that has a large transition magnetic moment with some other type of sterile neutrino, perhaps, and can you can evade the Lee-Weinberg bound by decaying through that, so you don't overclose the universe.
So there has been this neutrino beam from CERN to Francesca, right? Would it be conceivable to see something in a direct detection, dark matter direct detection experiment by having a neutrino using a sterile neutrino, which then emits a photon and this photon is well measured? I don't know if that's a problem.
Usually, in vitro against muscle lines, they don't like photons, so that's more background. So usually, photons won't work.
Well, but they would see it in the electronic photon.
Yeah, but normally you don't look at them. You can talk to them.
I don't know, in the published data, yeah, maybe they don't show this, but I think they put
it. No, you look at it, but there's no, you don't have a model to describe that, so even if you see more events there, unless you know what you're looking for, just looking like the, consider them events in that band. You know, if you look at their electron band,
right,
that's where you'll see it, right?
So you're saying there's ground by electron.
Yeah. So you need to really know,
yes,
but it may not be impossible. Maybe maybe it's a sharp line.
Yes,
friends, yeah.
Because these sharp lines, they can usually attribute to some,
yeah,
some many cases.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's interesting to wonder about that.
So you imagine that the lighter sterile is dark matter?
Or there could be some, it would have to be, I guess, for it to be stable, but yeah, it could annihilate through a T-channel exchange of the heavier sterile neutrinos and two photons, maybe you could.
Produce the right radical abundance, you mean?
Yeah, I haven't done any of the, it's just a very far off sort of thought, but it's something that this project kind of got Maxim and I sort of pondering, I guess, but not terribly productively yet. I'll just briefly mention UV conversion experiments and just to tell you numbers more or less, but if one is producing these sort of sterile neutrinos for similar muon capture processes, then you'd expect about this many events, since they're trying to produce about 10 to the 17 muon captures and probe branching ratios of the level 10 to the minus 16. So that would be a lot stronger than the 10 to the minus 8 branching ratios that are seen now. I think also they would be doing this on aluminum or something where the muon capture branching ratio is a lot larger than on hydrogen. And in an experiment like this, you might have access to something less weird than a sterile neutrino that decays only radiatively, maybe to all sorts of leptons. That's it, actually. There's some strange things that have been seen at various neutrino experiments. Probably it's a fairly prosaic explanation, but maybe it's something crazy, something fun. I'm crazy myself, I suppose, but one of these interesting ideas is this radiatively decaying sterile neutrino, but it seems that radiative muon capture experiments, or one in particular from the 90s, could potentially exclude this proposal, modulo some sort of ways out, but there might be ways to amend this model to fix these neutrino anomalies and then also solve other problems potentially. But I think the most interesting thing that I learned from working on this is that muon capture, which is a kind of old sort of process, can say a lot about new physics, basically. So that's it.
So what did those guys do that experiment in the first place, the muon capture experiment?
Oh, because they wanted to get basically... They wanted to get a picture of this form factor here. So, and it turns out that this gives you the best measurement. So if you look here, it might be too faint, but what you can see here are two different fits for different values of that form factor and zero momentum transfer. So you can constrain models of that try to tell you what those form factors should look like, essentially. And because since it's three-body final state, you have access to varying momentum transfers. And so even though you're down by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 relative to ordinary muon capture, you actually get a better, you tend to get better constraints because of, you need to fit this shape instead of just one number. So that's why they do it.
Yes. Your different A's you chose, 1, 0, and minus 1?
Yeah.
What is the motivated by? Like, I understand what physically is, of course, like, what they produce, the different photons, but what are they
motivated by?
Like, is that motivated by a different matrix element to choose for the dipole?
Yeah. So like essentially, what you
come on 5 zeros.
Right. Exactly. So you can have some 1 plus a number times gamma 5. Here,
right.
That I
and that maybe is that number, right?
Basically, yeah. So it's sort of the phase between them.
Yeah.
And then the reason that, well, so you get two diagrams. If you have Dirac neutrinos, then only one diagram contributes.
Right.
And then, if they're Majorana, they interfere, and that interference cancels out the angular dependence. So that's why if they're Majorana, then A is fixed. But if they're Dirac, in some sense, it's a free parameter. That's based on.
So there has been this comment on the paper by Monk. Did you already include answers to that, or?
Oh, so
what was the critique?
The critique was we handled just the A equals zero case, so that's fair. The other critique was that so you see here the bounds become quite weak for zero mass, and that's because the as this mass goes to zero, then it doesn't decay inside of your target, so the bounds get weak. What we originally did was just estimate the probability at 40 MeV and then apply that uniformly. So the bounds were wrong here, but they were actually more conservative for higher masses than 40 MeV, which is why we picked the lower end of the allowed range. So so previously, our bounds looked something straight line here, which is wrong. Straight line, and then it turns up a little more sharply here at higher masses. So what we did was just actually put the probability in as, or an estimate of the probability in as a function of this mass. So it turns out that, so that weakens our bounds less than 40 MeV, which is okay. Well, I mean, that range is more tightly constrained by pi in the case. But it strengthened the bound, actually, for the 40 to 8 window.
But if you plot his model
most likely parameter, like, you know, contour or whatever?
Yeah.
Where would that be?
Oh, sorry. So this is, so this range here corresponds to between here.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah.
But
well, so what do you mean most likely range then?
So his model parameter has the parameter, right? Mn and the mixing.
Yeah.
So if I drew a contour in this.
So it's greater typically. So the mass is between 40 and 80. So we're living here. And then the mixing is a few times 10 to the minus 3. So we're living somewhere here.
Okay.
So maybe, I mean, exactly at 40 MeV for A equals 1. It's about there. But
so there's no way to, is model cannot accommodate lighter.
Yes, then you start running into this problem. Yeah. Yeah, and then you would also, if you made it too light, you would also see things at Karman. Or would have seen things at Karman, for instance. So, but you can add a second star on the neutrino.
Sure.
And then, anything. Well, I guess you need to then actually look at what the spectrum is at LSMB, which we didn't do. But you could evade these constraints, but you might have a model that doesn't do anything else.
Well, you can just make your gamma be less than 6 MeV.
Right. So you pick A equals 1, and then you also tune your mass so that you get energetic enough stuff at LSD or mini moon, but nothing here at trying.
When Amigo came along, it was sold as being, it was going to resolve the LSD.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but it sounds like these anomalies never go away. But there's
I guess there's some conservation. Yeah. Right, it was supposed to, and I think sort of the mixing angle that you get from the mini-boon neutrino data is typically not compatible, I mean, unless you add extra neutrinos with LSD. And then, you know, there's crazy models, and then actually looked at anti-neutrinos, and then, oh, there's just not enough data, I guess, to definitively rule out else.
So what are the future experiments for looking at these anomalies? What are the testing in the
I don't know how many... Yeah, I don't know what's... going on besides T decay and double show, but they're looking at this beta 1 trigger angle. And then I guess that one at Fermilab. I don't know what the current status is actually.
Have you calculated what is the observable rate from mu to e gamma?
Alright.
So you can oscillate.
Yeah, so...
So you have a Ludwig case for the sterile...
So only, so I think then it's probably, you know, typical of standard kind of mu to e gamma rates. But you would get a much larger rate if this thing is radiatively decaying. So you don't have this room suppression. And if this mixing angle is large enough.
Because they see this axis in the Mu-J gamma experiment.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, in Meg.
Oh,
it's not statistically significant.
I see.
They actually see a few events.
Okay. It's interesting. So, right, maybe it's real.
Well, you should estimate what is the...
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point, yeah.
So what preparation ratio would they be sensitive to?
I think it's 10 to minus 11. The best fit is 10 to minus 11. Given how many, I think they see like 5 events.
So I'm sure you could just tune this to fit or the transition magnetic moment. And
the question is, once you have a transition magnetic moment, it also implies a lifetime.
Right.
And maybe that lifetime will be too long for you.
Right, okay.
I don't know, it's worth it.
Well, I suppose that the I mean, the branching ratio roughly is just this factor, more or less. So, out in front of it, it has 17, so.
Let's maybe discuss this discussion at lunch. We didn't have one.
Thanks, everyone.